I'm Tanzina Vega, and it's The Takeaway. So glad to have you with us. I hope your 2020 is off to a good start, but many of 2019's issues aren't going anywhere. And one of those is the high rates of homelessness across the U.S. So homelessness is often viewed as a local issue, something for cities and states to tackle. But in recent years, the federal government has taken a renewed interest in addressing it, especially in Democrat-led cities.
If these Democrat liberal politicians don't straighten out, the federal government will have to come in. We're not going to lose cities like Los Angeles, San Francisco, and others that are great cities. We're not going to allow that to happen to our cities.
President Trump there speaking about the issue of homelessness on a September visit to California, where the issue is especially acute. And last Saturday, the president doubled down on his criticism of how leaders in California and New York have handled homelessness in their states. In a tweet, he said California and New York must do something about their tremendous homeless problems and added that the governors in those states should be able to take care of the issue, quote, very easily. In December, the Trump administration picked Robert Marbit as the new director for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, but advocates are concerned about Marbit's history of pushing for the criminalization of homelessness, a trend that we see playing out across the country. According to the National Law Center on Homelessness and Poverty Rights, about 140 cities that their group tracked have at least one law restricting camping in public. The center has also reported that a person experiencing homelessness is up to 11 times more likely to be arrested than a person with housing. And President Trump has reportedly been considering an executive order to address homelessness, though details are vague. So to help us understand the rise and the criminalization of homelessness across the country, as well as how the federal government could play a role, we're joined by two guests today. Will James is a reporter with KNKX in Seattle, Washington, and Sarah Rankin is the director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle University School of Law. Will and Sarah, great to have you with us.
Hey, no problem.
Thanks so much.
Will, the big question is, why are we seeing this rise of homelessness across the United States?
Especially on the West Coast, homelessness is this glaring contradiction. You know, on the West Coast of the U.S., where we're seeing some of the most rapidly rising levels of homelessness, and the West Coast is actually, to an extent, driving some of these national increases in homelessness, the economy is sort of ascendant here at this moment. The two richest people on the planet live here in Washington State. Amazon is based here. Google and Facebook are based on the West Coast. And yet, when you drive down our highways and in our downtowns and in our wooded parks, you see thousands of people living in tents, in basically modern-day shanty towns. When you look at the trend lines, the closest correlation is between the rise in homelessness and the rise in rents. When rents go up, homelessness goes up. And that can be confusing because at an individual level, you do see a lot of people experiencing homelessness with really complex problems like substance use disorders, like severe and chronic mental illness. Increasingly, childhood trauma is seen as a factor in homelessness. But the simplest explanation is that there are too many people looking for too few apartments. And what ensues is kind of a game of musical chairs where the people left without a chair when the music stops are often the poorest, the most vulnerable, people with disabilities, people with severe and chronic mental illness, and disorders like substance use disorders.
Sarah, there are differences in how, sort of alluding to what Will was just saying, and how homelessness looks depending on where you are in the United States. You've talked about invisible homelessness. Tell us where you see more of that across the country.
So most folks don't understand the difference between homelessness generally, which is, for most people, very temporary and is not visible to folks because of couch surfing or doubling up with family members, as opposed to what you see when you look at people who are experiencing unsheltered homelessness, who are visible in the public eye. A lot of the folks who suffer from unsheltered homelessness are also considered chronically homeless. And there's a federal definition for that. It means that people experiencing chronic homelessness have to have been homeless longer than most other people experiencing homelessness, but they also have to suffer from a documentable disabling condition that prevents them from working. So examples would be people who are suffering from severe untreated mental illness, chronic health problems, and often co-occurring disorders. Those folks tend to be the majority of folks that you see unsheltered on the street.
One of the reasons why I'm interested in looking at this topic right now is because there's sort of been an increase in the criminalization of homelessness, if you will, and particularly people sleeping in public spaces. And I want to ask you both about the Supreme Court's recent decision not to hear the case of Martin v. Boise. Will, what is this case and what does it mean for the homeless?
Martin v. Boise is a case that stems from a man who was experiencing homelessness in Boise, Idaho, more than a decade ago, who got a ticket for falling asleep in an alley while he was waiting to get in a shelter. At the time, Boise was giving away a lot of tickets to people who were illegally sleeping on sidewalks, in parks, things like that. And, you know, some lawyers picked up on it. And it became this case that went for a decade until it reached the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals and ended up kind of scrambling the legal landscape for enforcing these sorts of rules all over the Western United States. The ultimate decision in Martin v. Boise that came down in late 2018, the best way to sum it up is that cities cannot punish someone for sleeping outside in places like parks or on sidewalks if there is no alternative place for them to go, like a shelter. What that did was kind of prevent a lot of cities from dealing with homelessness the way they traditionally had, which is by treating it as kind of a public safety enforcement issue by kind of moving it out of sight.
Yeah, and I would read Martin v. Boise a little differently in that I think that the holding in Martin v. Boise is that cities can't punish people for surviving in public when they have no reasonable alternative. It doesn't require cities to provide adequate shelter. It doesn't prevent cities from being able to enforce their laws in ways that allow for the protection of public health and public safety. The holding itself is actually quite narrow. The criminalization of homelessness, it's a fancy word, but basically what it means is that cities across the country have been enacting an enormous web of laws that punish people for surviving in public even when they have no reasonable alternative but to do so. So examples of anti-survival laws include laws that prohibit or severely restrict one's ability to sit, stand, ask for help, protect oneself from the elements, receive food. The act of surviving in public is so tightly regulated that people experiencing unsheltered homelessness are doomed to get caught up in the web.
But this feels very much like these are cosmetic solutions, if you will, that people in cities don't want to see the encampments. They don't want to see homelessness. Is it more about the optics of homelessness versus homelessness being a threat to public safety, Sarah?
You know, I've written a lot about the role of stereotypes and prejudices in the way that our laws and policies operate. The way that we define public health and public safety is from the perspective of housed people. So if you look at some inactivity, a common popular activity like sweeps, which major urban cities spend tens of millions of dollars doing every single year, what those are really exercises in futility. It's moving very vulnerable people from Will's neighborhood to Sarah's neighborhood, giving Will the impression that the problem has been solved when it hasn't.
Will, President Trump is expected to sign an executive order on homelessness. Some of the reporting so far that we're hearing is that this may, in fact, increase resources to police departments so that they can continue to do these sweeps, particularly on homeless encampments. You have done a lot of reporting on the West Coast on homelessness, Will. What does it look like for a police department or law enforcement to sweep a community?
I've covered a number of these events. You know, what it looks like is usually in some cases, especially in more recent years, since there's been a lot of advocacy around this, there is some forewarning people are asked to prepare for this sweep and a date is given. So in some cases, people stay up through the night to kind of pack everything they own to try to get it together in a situation where they can move. Often when the police come, people are still scrambling to gather everything they own into, you know, a situation where they can carry it, or getting help from advocacy organizations to pack it into the back of a van or something. You see people leaving things behind in a lot of cases. In a lot of these sweeps, I've actually seen once a sort of deadline is hit, let's say the sweep happens at 9 a.m., once everyone is cleared from the site, a bulldozer comes in and kind of just crushes all of the tents and makeshift houses that people have built in the encampments. And people kind of just scatter to the wind. And often after that, you see an encampment crop up somewhere else in the same city.
Sarah, tell us about the new Trump administration pick for the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness, Robert Marbot.
He has a reputation among homeless rights advocates as something of a snake oil salesman. He purports to have expertise on homelessness, but his ideas really fly in the face of well-established proof of what works. He has described his approach to homelessness as a velvet hammer. He's something of a godfather of punitive approaches to homelessness. And this stems from his belief that unsheltered people choose homelessness, and that offering them food or other services actually enables them and makes them too comfortable. So he has a track history of advancing sort of mass congregate shelters and forced treatment, even though studies have shown that those sorts of approaches are harmful and ineffective. He's also pretty famously said that he believes in housing forth, which is, I suppose, his policy that unsheltered people must prove themselves worthy of housing before they can be rewarded with it. And this really flies in the face of decades of evidence that an approach called housing first actually solves homelessness. It's the most studied intervention in all of homelessness policy, and it's been proven repeatedly to be the most humane and cost-effective solution to chronic unsheltered homelessness.
Well, I want to bring this back to you as we close out the segment here, because a lot of the work you do is in Seattle. And as you mentioned, Silicon Valley is there. A lot of titans of technology and wealth are there. What are they doing to, if anything, to remedy the homeless situation in their backyards, literally? I mean, these are companies that profess to want to make the world a better place. Have they stepped in? Amazon and Microsoft and any of these folks?
Certainly, you've seen philanthropic efforts kind of emerge. Jeff Bezos, of course, the founder of Amazon, recently announced kind of an influx of money into dealing with homelessness. The Gates Foundation has dealt with this issue, certainly. But in Seattle, there was a huge fight not very long ago about an effort to impose a tax on certain corporations that would have affected Amazon and raised money specifically to respond to homelessness. Amazon fought that tax tooth and nail, and the city council ended up repealing it. So while we have seen, you know, some action on the philanthropic front, there also have been instances of these tech giants really, really resisting efforts to be taxed to solve this crisis.
Will James is a reporter with KNKX in Seattle, Washington, and Sarah Rankin is the director of the Homeless Rights Advocacy Project at Seattle University School of Law. Thanks to you both for joining us.
Thanks, Tanzina.
There's a lot going on right now. Mounting economic inequality, threats to democracy, environmental disaster, the sour stench of chaos in the air. I'm Brooke Gladstone, host of WNYC's On the Media. Want to understand the reasons and the meanings of the narratives that led us here, and maybe how to head them off at the pass? That's On the Media's specialty. Take a listen wherever you get your podcasts.